Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 298, recorded Wednesday, April 26th, for Monday, May 15th, Gretchen Bakke. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Betterment, a smart, easy-to-use, and less expensive way to invest for your financial future. Get 1 month managed free when you make an initial deposit of $10,000 or more at betterment.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to the smartest people working in technology today. And today I'm super excited to talk to Gretchen Bakke. She is the author of The Grid, the Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. It is a great book. Thank you for coming on the show, Gretchen.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you are an anthropologist by trade and a professor. What got you interested in writing about the electrical grid?
It's actually the story in the book sort of hidden in between the lines, which is that I was really surprised. I'm from rural Oregon, and I was really surprised to begin to see after a series of fairly catastrophic storms for rural communities to see people losing faith in the grid as a utility provided, and for them kind of a state provided. It's not where they got their electricity from, but it's sort of who they thought was providing their electricity. This was somehow the state government that was in charge of making sure their power stayed on. And it just in a very non-radical way slipped away from that idea. And that was happening in 2007, 2008. And I thought, this is odd. It's interesting to see this thing like now we think of drinking water in Flint, for example. It's a much more radical example, but just to have people without any fanfare saying, I'm sort of done with relying on this system. I'm going to figure out a backup for myself. And so that's really where it started from, and especially linked to, they started to have these conversations about how bad diesel generators were because you had to have diesel to fill them up with, and how angry they were at the town because they weren't allowed to have small wind turbines and it's cloudy all the time. So you couldn't have solar, and how were they going to actually create some sort of energy security for themselves given that the utility couldn't do it anymore? And so there was kind of a level of nuanced policy understanding and infrastructure understanding and supply chain understanding that was very surprising to me for, public school teachers and nurses and just shop owners, just townsfolk. So I started to follow that, and that almost immediately led me in Oregon again to the problem of all of the wind that was being installed at that point and continues to be installed in the Columbia River Gorge, and how that was sort of wreaking havoc on the grid locally. What happened, though, in the process of learning about the system is that the changes that have been happening to our electrical system have taken off since 2008. And so that was just good luck on my part. I mean, I saw the beginnings of it, but just watching how fast everything has changed. And in 2008, the worry was like wind, 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 wind. How are we going to deal with all the wind? And now it's, distributed solar. How are we going to deal with all the distributed solar? We've just kind of figured out the wind problem and we're on to the next problem. But this mass integration of renewables that is just sort of tumbling forward, the retirement of coal, people being sort of mad and turning off nuclear power plants, all of these things have really significant ramifications on the way that the infrastructure, the electricity system is working.
Bill Gates picked it as one of his favorite books of last year, and he called it his favorite genre, books about topics that seem mundane but are actually interesting, which is one of my favorite genres of books as well. So why don't you talk a little bit. The book begins with a description of Grid Week, which I had never heard of. You make it sound sort of like a very, very tame, like fraternity rush, and maybe like a Boy Scout camp. There are a lot of mostly men sitting around discussing our electrical grid. Talk a little bit about Grid Week and why it's important.
So it's still happening. It happens every year. So you can go. I think it's now called Smart Grid Week. I think they added smart in. And at that time, I would guess probably still now, it was so people who were somewhere in the upper echelons of their companies, often utility companies, sometimes government, sometimes startups, more of that today, sitting down to just talk about the changes that were happening to the grid. And what was interesting is that I was at the fifth grid week that year. The year that is talked about in the book was the fifth one. And the first one had like 250 people. By the time I got there, there were around 5,000. Now it's gigantic. Wow. So this interest, and it's also gotten younger. But essentially it is just some people from government coming at that time. The Secretary of Energy was there. Secretary of Commerce was there. Just talking about where the government thought things were going, and then companies talking about, in some ways, like how to get government money. That was a lot of what was going on. I overheard a conversation, which is not in the book, which was, it went roughly like this, like, "Oh, hey, Bob, I didn't know you were interested in the grid." and Bob said, "Well, you know, we're interested in subsidy money." You know? So it was this kind of mix of people who are deeply invested in creating standards. And this is, again, like one of these insanely boring things that is so important to how the grid actually works, because the grid is so big and so complicated that there are all of these standards. And as it gets more and more smartness into it, those standards are just exploding. So there's all these people who are really invested in sitting in meetings and writing these standards together with people who are there to kind of figure out how to make a buck. And that's part of what I love about the grid. I mean, that's why the book itself becomes this American story about this mix, all of these mix of kind of characters and values and ideas and systems, and like people working for the public good, nonprofit companies, for-profit companies, companies that people hate, companies that people love, hippies, senators, you know, like they're all Wall Street, you know, venture capital guys. They're all kind of coming together in the production of this infrastructure. And they have been doing that since the very beginning. And so Grid Week was just this kind of this way of seeing what's happening now. And it was there that I learned about sort of the fiasco in Boulder, Colorado, because it was really this moment at which the smart grid city, which was the idea for Boulder, was still being talked about as this sort of dream. While simultaneously, there were people there from Boulder who were saying, you know, these are people who work in the electricity industry who are saying, "Ah, stupid smart meter. Like, I just took that thing off my wall and put it in a drawer." So you had the talk about how awesome everything was going to be right next to the activities involved and how awesome it wasn't.
You mentioned before at Grid Week, and you talked about how, you know, someone said, "Hey, Bob, are you interested in the grid too?" And it's an interesting combination of people who are interested. I grew up in Texas, where you don't necessarily think of as a place that is teeming with environmentalists, but they have a huge wind power industry there. And it's mostly an area of economic growth for them, right?
I think one of the things about Texas that's phenomenal is that there is this idea that it's somehow, because there's a lot of conservative politics, then there wouldn't be green energy. But in fact, because Texas has its own grid, and this is, we can maybe step back and say, what is a grid? Because a lot of people don't actually have a good sense of that. But in the U.S., we have three of them. We have one for the West, one for the East, and Texas has its own. And this is historically, this was a historical case because it allows for secession. So it was this way of making sure that if Texas needed to leave the U.S., it could do that easily. And so they have their own grid. That means that they're barely regulated by federal regulation for electricity, because that federal regulation is for electricity that crosses state boundaries. So Texas can kind of do what it wants. That means that there's all kinds of creativity that's going on there. And because Texas knows how to make money in the energy business, that's something that there's a lot of people in Texas that have experience with. And because people knew for a long time that oil money wouldn't last forever, there's been a lot of investment in wind. And now, because the wind in Texas blows at night, there's coming up a lot of investment in solar. So there'll be a huge amount of solar is going in Texas for daytime electricity. There's already a huge amount of wind in Texas for nighttime electricity. And that's that makes it, I think it's the highest wind capacity in the world. It's non-negligible, the amount of wind that's being made in Texas. So much so that there is one utility in Texas that at 9 p.m. your electricity is free after 9 p.m. because the wind does blow at night. And so you can kind of imagine half of Texas standing up at 9 p.m. and walking over and pressing the button on their dishwasher, you know, turning on the laundry machine. And so when we talk about the Internet of Things and this sort of jumbling things together, but we can try to get to sort of tease it all out. But when we talk about the Internet of Things, it just means somebody doesn't have to stand up and walk over and press a button, right? That right. The machine itself will already know what's happening with the grid and will be able to respond to that appropriately. But this this kind of forward-looking or, I would guess, ample attitude towards new energy sources that you see in Texas, it's happening in all of the states that have a long history of engagement in the energy sector. So Ohio is also quite forward-looking. And this is, I think, surprising to people that being conservative in all kinds of political ways doesn't actually map onto being conservative in terms of renewable energy.
Absolutely. So, yes, let's talk about storing electricity. You know, say the sun is shining during the day and then the wind is at night. You know, I just moved, so I had solar panels. We put solar panels on our old house, and we live in California, and looking into it now. But, you know, in California, we're told, you know, I don't actually use the electricity that I get from the sun. So we're sort of told by PG&E that it's just stored for when we need it. But what you're saying is that the grid has to manage all that. You know, during the day and during the night. So is it not storing this energy?
It's not storing electricity.
Oh.
There are three giant batteries that have just gone online in California. And those are a result of this Aledo Canyon natural gas facility that was leaking like a sieve. And so California decided that they needed to check all of the natural gas infrastructure. And because they've made the transition away from coal and away from nuclear, natural gas is what California largely relies upon for its base. And so suddenly pulling that out meant that there was going to be a problem of reliability. So that meant that these big battery projects, which were sort of in the works and were being kind of carefully worked out, they were suddenly pushed ahead at 125% or 200%. The stories about how they built them are kind of crazy because it's, you know, it's three shifts and they're just working around the clock. And those have literally just come online. So nobody really knows yet how they're going to work in relationship to the grid. But that's basically it for this very, very, very grid scale storage. Anywhere on the grid. And it's something that's really important about electricity. And both the design of the electricity markets throughout the 20th century and the way that they're treated today treat electricity or conceptualize electricity, think electricity as if it were an object, as if it were a banana. But it's not. It's a force. And so it has totally different physical rules that apply to it than everything else that's in our world. Everything else that we make, we buy, we stockpile, we sell, we can choose between. It just doesn't work that way. So electricity, when it's made, it's essentially in an electrical generator. You have an atom and the electron, it's a tearing electron. It's using energy. So it's using, let's say, natural gas to tear electrons off of atoms. And every time it tears one of those electrons off, that electron moves like a tiny, tiny bit. I'll make it like this, but it's much tinier than that. And it bumps an electron. It's going at a high speed. It bumps an electron off of an atom that's just next to it. And that electron bumps along. And it hits an electron out of an atom that's just next to it. So each of these electrons is seeking a new nucleus to be attached to. And it's kind of like this domino chain. And what I like to say to people is when you think about the domino chain of these like tap, tap, tap that makes all the dominoes fall down, you notice that there is no force without the domino. It's not that there's something separate from the domino. And that's what's amazing about electricity is that when you look at electrical lines, there is no electricity inside those lines. The lines and the electricity are exactly the same thing. You can't untangle the substance from the force even though it looks like just cool metal, actually that cool metal is just very apt to losing electrons. Copper, for example, it's very easy for an electron to separate another electron. And that's so we build stuff that we want electricity to move through easily out of conductive materials, which just means this kind of, they're sort of flimsily attached to the electrons. And you'll notice I don't talk like an engineer about this process. But that happens so fast that when you throw, I'll go to a coal burning plant now. So you throw a lump of coal into a coal burning plant. It's pulverized. It's flash combusted. Pow! Within the next second, somebody's using that electricity. Within the next minute, that's about as far as it can go. The production of electricity, how much coal you're putting into that coal burning plant, needs to be balanced, because effectively there's no storage for electricity. It needs to be balanced with somebody turning on the light in their kitchen, if you want that light to go on.
Right.
That's a phenomenally complicated project.
Yeah.
And then you think, like, this grid, it's the size of a half of a continent. So it's all kinds of power plants, all different kinds of power plants that are hooked into that system, and all different kinds of loads, which is what we are. You know, our dishwashers, our lights, our electric cars, if we have them, our big screen TVs, our charging our telephones. Every time you do that, there's somehow less than a minute. The thing that's going into your phone battery, or right now into my computer battery, was a drop of water, was a gust of wind, was a lump of coal. It's very, very fast. So with no storage, then balancing something like wind, which sometimes blows harder and sometimes softer, or the sun, which, you know, is not there for half of a day. And even has little clouds kind of scud along the sky and they cover up a solar panel and electricity dips. When the cloud goes over, a little puffy white cloud. So balancing that, making the electricity system not blink out every time there's a cloud in a place that has a lot of solar power, that's a giant project. And that's the project that, in some ways, the title, The Fraying Wires, of the book, The Fraying Wires, it alludes to the fact that the grid is quite old. But the challenges actually have to do not just with, like, making sleeker wires. It has to do with rethinking the very structure of the system to accommodate all of these renewables. It's totally doable. People are often like, oh, it can't be done, over 25%, we can't do it. It's just really, really hard. So every time someone puts up a new solar panel, this is done without much consideration of what that actually means for a common electricity system. Because as you mentioned, you're not using that solar power yourself. When your utility says you're storing it, it just means somebody else is using that power right now. And later, when you use electricity, you're going to use power that's made by some other means.
Well, what about the...
You're on the grid.
What about the power walls, Elon Musk, the Tesla power walls? Like, that sort of implies also that, you know, okay, I can have my own storage of electricity, but that's not, obviously, by what you just described. How do the power walls work?
Yeah, so the power wall is interesting. This is the next step. Right. So the next step is we have this substantial problem in places that have a lot of solar power called dusk. So it seems so trivial, right? Dusk. But so at dusk, the sun is beginning to go down. So solar panels, especially ones facing south, are not picking up very much, are not making very much solar power anymore. And yet we're all still really active. And in fact, this evening peak, which is sort of the evening when we all use our power, it's because there are still people at work. So all the buildings are still on. There are people going home. So all the restaurants, all the public spaces are still on. And there are people at home and they're opening their fridge, right? Like 17 times in an hour before dinner. And they're, you know, right? So all of that electricity is on. So not only is solar sort of going down, but electricity need is going up. And so very often, any kind of solar technology, if they're talking about having storage associated with it, it's often this weird, like, 4 hours of storage. So if you have these molten salt towers, they have 6 hours of storage. Elon Musk's battery, it's like, okay, you can run things at 4 hours. And what this does is it allows you to take care of this 5 to 9 p.m. period of time without stressing the grid. So distributed storage of this sort, and I'll talk about batteries in a second because they're tricky, but distributed storage of this sort, it means that it's a way to begins to privatize little pieces of the grid, but it's also part of this reconceptualization that I was talking about, where instead of making more generation to balance out the peak, so that's what we used to do, we still do in a lot of places. A lot of natural gas plants are even called peakers because they just turn on at this sort of dusk time. It was always a problem, even before solar. It's just a bigger problem now if you're using solar power, if you have a lot of solar power on a grid. So instead of creating more generation at that time, there's, for example, in solar states, you can have, in Hawaii, 250% of the electricity that's needed at noon is often produced just by the rooftop panels that are already up. So it's a way to store that for these 4 hours later in the day. This is not operationalized yet, but it's the idea. And the place where it is does seem to be happening the most effectively is actually Vermont, because the utility, they have a ton of solar, which is kind of weird because it's a gray northern place. But people really like solar there. And the utility is actually helping people afford to have these Tesla Powerwalls and giving the utility access to them. So the utility can store electricity in people's home batteries. And people with solar systems, ideally not yet, but can also store electricity in home batteries. The issue right now is that everybody that's producing electricity is still hooked up to the grid, essentially. And so figuring out how to allow people to go into what's called island mode, so to actually unhook from the grid and use a system inside their house, like a 4 hour battery backup, when that's really good for the grid. And then it's also good for them because electricity is, tariffs are going to be changing everywhere. The cost of electricity is going to be marked by demand in a way that it hasn't really been before. So you'll have this, what's called a time of day rate. And this dusk period is going to be the most expensive time of day. So it would be to the homeowner's advantage, if we're still talking about homeowners or the renter's advantage, if there's solar actually on their roof, to use this home system during that time. It would save them money. But that hasn't been done yet. It will happen. And I would guess that it will be something kind of normal by 2020, but it opens this terrible door, which nobody wants to see opened, which is that once you give people that capacity, they can start to sell electricity between each other. They can go around the utility. Mm. So, and that is also coming, but it's very, very scary.
Why is it scary? Do you mean scary to the utility companies?
It's scary to the utility companies. It's very, very scary to the utility companies. And it's also very scary to the people who manage the grid, because suddenly you're going to have people selling and buying willy-nilly without thinking at all about what wires are capable of and what wires are there. It's already hard enough to plan anything, given the complexity of the system. So trying to understand how to make, it's called person-to-person energy trading, how to make that something that isn't actually dangerous to the well-being of the system as a whole. It's going to be a project, and it is happening now. Auckland, New Zealand has a trial in place with 500 different entities that are doing this. And the Netherlands, you should see, they have this beautiful little video about, it's all in Dutch, which you don't even need to understand it. But it's basically like, look at these friendly, nice, good people who can make electricity for you, you know, they have a platform. So they have sort of an Uber style platform for person to person energy trading. So it's, the people are kind of like little by little working these things out. But you can see how different from probably your situation even today, of like, you're a PG&E customer. You probably don't get to pick anybody else that you could buy your electricity from except PG&E. You have to accept the rates that PG&E gives you. PG&E has to accept those rates from regulators. And those regulators often have to set those rates based on what the legislature has said. So it's just a very, very different, you know, this is how it works right now. And suddenly it's going to become all scrambly.
Mm-hmm. Right. You just have to trust that you're making this amount of solar energy and that, you know, that whatever it's worth and that sort of thing. Yeah. But I don't want to sell my own power. I don't want to get involved in that.
No, but you don't need to want to, but for the moment, like if you have solar panels, let's say you have solar panels and you have on your roof right now. And this is, again, why people actually like diesel generators. So you have solar panels on your roof and your neighbor has a diesel generator and the power goes out, there's blackout. If your neighbor is allowed to run their diesel generator during a blackout, so they would have light and you wouldn't, because you're not allowed to use your solar panels during a blackout. So they'll have, so that's the first thing. They'll have power you won't. And the second thing is that if they go into their kitchen and they turn on a light in the kitchen, there's all of this very, very heavy machinery inside the generator that is effectively storing electricity in inertial force. So it can change how much electricity output it is making to accommodate that new light. But a solar panel doesn't have that. So even if your system were designed to function for you during a power outage, which is not currently designed for that, but even if it was designed for that, you go and turn on a light, there's no way for that solar panel to produce more electricity at that particular instant. And that's where people start to say, well, then we need storage that can like have these, you know, that can be reactive in this way. But actually inertial force is just a lot easier. I was with somebody yesterday who was referring to it as an anchor. If you don't have an anchor, your boat is going to float away. And it's a little bit like that. It's just inertial force on the system is gigantic, and it allows for a lot of flexibility in sort of in this like 60 seconds that you have from production to use. It allows for machinery to speed up and slow down to keep everything in sync. Mm-hmm. And you simply don't have that on a home solar system. So these are the things that need to get worked out. It's not that they won't get worked out or that I'm somehow like doom and gloom about how it's all going to go down, but it is why people are using to put diesel generators, you know, connect them to their house rather than to put on a solar system.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about dusk and when we don't have enough power. I want to talk about what happens when there's too much power, too much wind, too much power to the grid. But first, I want to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors. And speaking of technology that holds up the world, you can also use technology to invest and help you manage your money. Everyone needs to invest for their financial future, for themselves or their family. And we're geeks. We like to use technology to do it. And it is easy to use technology with Betterment. Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service. It's changed the industry by making investing easier than you've ever seen it. It's at a fraction of what you would pay for traditional financial services. You've seen tech transform commerce, entertainment, ride sharing, home security, but you can also use it to invest better. Betterment combines smart technology with human advisors to achieve optimal results at every level of investment. Customers gain access to a team of CFP professionals and licensed financial experts who monitor accounts and are able to answer your questions. You also receive planning calls and notifications throughout the year, just little check-ins that help you invest. Betterment's goal-based investing framework and advice algorithm will let you know if you're on track in just seconds. You can also securely sync outside investments with Betterment so you can see your total net worth all in one place. Smart deposits allow you to automatically invest excess cash. So you know you want to save and invest that money, but who can remember that when you have extra money? That's why Smart Deposits uses an algorithm. Retirement Guide provides a consolidated view of your retirement and calculates your retirement gap. Betterment's tax loss harvesting will help lower investment taxes and then increase after-tax returns. There's no trade, transaction, or rebalancing fees, and there's no minimum to sign up. Through global diversification, smart rebalancing, and lower fees, Betterment customers can expect higher returns than a typical DIY investor. Their end-to-end investing means faster cash transfers, tax forms available at the earliest possible date, and secure investing. As with everything in life, investing involves risk. Right now, get 1 month managed free when you make an initial deposit of $10,000 or more. To learn more, visit betterment.com/triangulation. That's betterment.com/triangulation. Betterment, investing made better. I am talking to Gretchen Bakke. She is the author of The Grid. She is an anthropologist and a professor. We've been talking about energy and what happens when there's not enough at dusk, when everyone's relying on solar energy. But what about if there's too much? Can you talk a little bit about like what happens on a particularly windy day? What happens to the grid?
So on a particularly windy day or a particularly sunny day, depending on what kind of generation you've put up, this variable generation, either wind or solar, tidal is also variable. When there's a lot of wind, the wind turbines spin faster. When there's less wind, they spin less fast. When there's no wind, they don't spin at all. And from the 20th century, we have this fear from oil, from the history of oil, of shortage. We won't have enough. We won't have enough. We won't have enough. But actually with renewable power, the problem is often that we have too much. It's very easy to just produce too much electricity and not, you know, not too much necessarily all around the clock, but too much for a particular period in time. And because electricity production and electricity use has to always be balanced, if you suddenly flood the grid with a bunch of electricity, you have to find people to use it. And you have to find people to use it, and you also have to have the carrying capacity. So you have to have the lines to bring that electricity to the people who will use it. And the way it used to work in the old days, when things were simpler, is that somebody at the utility would call up somebody who had a power, had a plant who was like making paper, a paper mill, for example, and say, hey, could you maybe like work a little harder right now? Or, you know, like we have all this electricity, we need it to go somewhere. So we'll just give it to you for free, but we need you to use it. And the reason for that is that if you have, if you have too much on the wires are rated for a certain amount, they basically have a fuse on them. So they'll turn themselves off self-protectively, so that they don't burn out. And if they don't do that, then they burn out and you have to replace pieces of them. You have to get guys up on those little cherry pickers, you know, that can go up and like super dangerous job, but they know what they're doing, but super dangerous job. So you don't want that. It's very expensive. So the lines, they click off, just like your house's surge protector would click off. And then the electricity isn't going anywhere and you get a blackout. So there's, in a way, like you can see a blackout as being kind of a lovely self-protective mechanism for the grid, but it's not great for us. And it's really not great for computers. And, you know, just any industry that shuts down when there's a blackout has to put a lot of energy in to start back up again. So when I say that at noon in Hawaii now, they regularly are producing 250% of the electricity they need, this is a crisis.
Right.
For Hawaii, it's also great because Hawaii has the most expensive electricity in the country. They have oil that comes in on tankers. Then they have to like run that oil through a pipeline from the port into the power plant. It's phenomenally expensive. There's all kinds of risk in terms of environmental sort of destruction as those pipelines leak, or, you know, there's all kinds of problems. So suddenly they have the solar resource, they're using it, but they have too much. They have too much at noon. So it's sort of the testing ground right now. If you want to go on vacation and learn about the grid, the place to go is Hawaii.
That's good. 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 I can write it off maybe.
Exactly.
Your book also contains this fascinating backgrounder on electricity, the history. And one of the things I loved reading about was that we discovered electricity long before we knew what to do with it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, we think of it as this very somehow common or necessary product. But no, we actually, the electric battery was invented 100 years essentially before people started to get electricity regularly in their homes. We could make electricity for 30 years, very, you know, quite reliably make electricity for 30 years before anybody had any idea what it would be good for. But there was sort of simultaneously, it was understood that there was a need for better light. So there were a lot of people who was like, we have this electricity thing. We need better lighting systems. There must be a way to bring these two things together. So the early history of electricity, which, you know, there's a new movie coming out, another one of these, you know, brilliant geniuses, bat heads, kind of Edison, Tesla movies. People love that story. You know, they just love it. It never gets old. But what was actually going on with, there was a man before Edison whose name was Charles Brush, who had invented a lighting system that was quite popular. You know, there were 17 brush grids in New York before Edison had his first grid came on in 1882. So he, in a way, this idea of like, how will we make a system that uses electricity to make light? What are the physics of that project? What are the economics of that project? Who will we sell it to? It's a very capitalist story. It's about creating a product that one can actually somehow get people to consume, and who those people will be, right? And in the early days of electricity, those people were rich people and companies. And that was true all the way through Until the 1910s, 19-teens, about 100 years ago, there was a guy in Chicago who had been Edison's secretary, personal secretary, and then took over the Edison franchise in Chicago, who realized that actually you could make a lot of money on electricity by selling it very cheaply to a lot of people. And he began to build these systems that became universal electrification. In the Great Depression, it became universal electrification because the cities were actually largely electrified following Samuel Insull's model, and the rural areas were still dark. And so as it became understood that electricity was some kind of common good that would provide for the uplift of the entire nation, the government stepped in during the Great Depression to make sure that the whole nation had access to the same quality of electrical service, even in places where you could never make a profit off of it. So that's how we got universal electrification. And then the electricity story really changed to be about what can we sell people that will make them use more electricity. So you can see the 1950s as this sort of, you know, stupendous story of figuring out what to sell people so that they would use more electricity, so that their electricity bill would go up, because once everybody had access to it, it was priced very, very low, continues to be priced very, very low in most places in the United States. The issue was get them to use more. So then you have companies like GE, which we now think of as an appliance company, but it was a part of this shift from it was Edison General Electric. It was about supplying electricity, and then it became about supplying refrigerators, very, very power hungry refrigerators. So that's the very fast story, And then, you know, the conservation becomes part of it. Environmental degradation, people begin to understand what all of this consumption is actually having an effect on the world. Electricity, like the idea of efficiency and conservation comes in the, I would say already in California in the late 1950s because of the smog crisis, but certainly by the late 1960s with the nuclear power plants, 1970s, all the way up until Three Mile Island, everybody's learning to turn off the light when they leave the room. And the electric companies are completely stunned because they've never had a decrease in consumption in the entire history of their working world. Consumption has always gone up. And suddenly it wasn't. And actually in the U.S. today, even though we're adding a lot of people and we're adding a lot of machines, the efficiency is getting so good on these machines. It has, in fact, become an industrial value to create a machine which is electrically efficient. That use in the U.S. has been flatlined since 2007.
Wow. That's shocking with all of the everything that we all the devices that we have. When I look at my surge protector at home and the 5 iPads that are plugged into it.
Exactly. We should use way more electricity, but each generation is more efficient. And again, I was just talking to somebody last week who said that they'd replaced their fridge and their electric bill went down by half.
Wow.
So it's just, even with computers, like each generation of computer will use half as much electricity. So each time you update your computer, it's a much better machine from that point of view. But this, you know, this again adds to the story. It adds another layer to the story of how do we manage this electricity system, which is not following in all kinds of ways, in economic ways, in ways related to physics, in ways related to business plans, in ways related to people's ideas about what is good and what they want from, or how they can intervene in an electricity system. All of these, the planetary good, right? All of these things are changing simultaneously, and they all have to do with the grid.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gets back to what you said before, like electricity is not a banana. So, you know, when I plug in my super efficient computer versus when my daughter is straightening her hair with the, you know, 3-year-old straightening iron, and you're able to see how much electricity, if we're able to actually see how much one of those, you would assume that the computer would take a lot more, but really, like, you have no idea. We have this lack of knowledge about how much electricity our devices are taking or using.
Yeah, and I have this secret theory that one of the reasons that people like this deal where they where you get solar panels and then you pay a set rate every month, like as if that was part of a mortgage, as opposed to getting this electric bill that makes no sense. I have this theory that part of the reason for the solar explosion isn't that people are suddenly paying less money for power, or that it's cheaper, or they have this some sort of, you know, financial self-interest. It's just they understand the bill. you know, because nobody understands their electric bill. And you can make all of these choices about not, for example, not using as much electricity, make everything super conservative, get the Nest thermostat, do all this stuff, and your electric bill can go up. Right. And it's because there's time of day tariffs in there. It's because you pay more for the first set number of kilowatt hours you use in any billing period than you pay for the ones after that. There's all of that is hidden in the structure of the bill, making it almost impossible to do things in your life and see them reflected on that piece of paper, virtual piece of paper.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is the transparency is what we're missing. And that's one of the things I also really loved about your book. You go into this very clear description of what voltage means. And I won't ask you to explain it here, but definitely it's in the book. And, you know, it's something that you don't necessarily think of, but, you know, you walk through it in a way that's really easy to understand for non-scientists. So,
yeah. And I did that because I needed to know how. I mean, I really am an anthropologist. I was an anthropologist of art before I started this project. And so I was like, I don't understand voltage. I'm going to pick up a book, right? There is absolutely no way. There is nothing out there that helps us understand, helps regular people understand how electricity works. It's all written for engineers. And so I said, I'm going to figure out a way to talk about these things that anyone can understand, that I would have understood, you know, 3 years earlier, my 3 years earlier self. And so I spent a lot of time writing all of the descriptions of the physics and then giving them to people who were actually electrical engineers and saying, is this actually right? Like if I use all of these words, which are none of the words that you use, right? And no formulas, nothing, none of that, does it actually capture what's happening? And so in the end, I got to a description which they agreed made sense and which anybody can understand.
I find myself, because I understand technology, but then when we start talking about wireless charging and, you know, why can't, like, we just charge our devices in the air, that sort of thing, then I get to realize, like, wow, I understand everything except for how the electricity gets there and how all of that works. And I feel like I need an electrical engineering degree to understand it. So let's talk a little bit about wireless charging. I mean, you talked about Tesla and Edison, and now everyone's fascinated with that story. And I mean, maybe this was a gap in my elementary school 1980s education, but I remember learning again and again about Edison, but not about Tesla. And now you hear a lot more about Nikola Tesla. Do you think that has to do with our fascination with wireless charging right now?
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting point. I had not thought of that, but I think he's a very sort of sexy guy for nerds, you know, like, and there are a lot of nerds, you know, there's a lot. And there's something he's super bright. He's super quirky. He had, obsessive compulsive disorder. So he was always, you know, washing everything. He couldn't touch a woman because they oozed, you know, like, it's just like, he's just this sort of wonderful story also embedded in this like 16-year-old who figures out how to create he's not 16, he was 19. I don't know, but he figures out how to create an alternating current motor, which was the big problem with alternating current, wasn't that you couldn't make it. In fact, most generators were alternating current and then converted to direct current. This is for people who love this Edison Tesla story. This is gonna make total sense, right? But he figured out how to make, but you didn't have a motor. So the motors actually ran on direct current, and he figured out how to make an alternating current motor, which is why we have the grid we have today that runs on alternating current. He figured it out on the dirt, in the dirt with a stick, right? So Edison was not that guy. Edison was not particularly bright. He was not particularly well educated. He was incredibly stubborn, and he had this amazing ability to disregard everybody's advice. So people would say to him, you can't put more than, this is in the book, but you can't put more than 7 lights on any generator. Like this is against the rules of physics. Electricity does not work that way. And he was like, phooey, we need more lights than that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So he worked in practice, not in theory. And Tesla, he worked in theory, not in practice. So, and some of his theory, like his tower with the balloons that was going to use the electricity in the ionosphere to like give all of us long, like electricity infinitely, like that, none of that, it was a great idea. He got a lot of funding for it, but it, It was never written down, the plan exactly. And nobody can figure out how it would actually be possible. So he was sure. And since he was brilliant, maybe he was right. You know, maybe he was sure and it died in his head. Or maybe he was wrong.
But he's fascinating.
We don't know. But the idea, the fact that wires are irritating is the truest thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people are done with wires. Mm-hmm. And electricity, you kind of need wires. So the question is how to bring these two things into relationship. And wireless charging, you see this. When I wrote the book, it was just beginning, but now it's quite common that you would have a little circle. They have at the coffee shop down the street. There's like little circles on the table. And if you put your phone there, it charges while it's there. This wireless charging that goes about two feet, maybe even further than that. So that, for example, anything that's tuned, your device would still be tuned to something that's behind your wall. So you wouldn't have electromagnetism going through your body. But your phone would still be being charged. So the wires would still be there, but they'd be inside the wall. And all of your stuff would seem as if it was magically just always had a full charge. That exists, and there are companies that are sort of duking it out behind the scenes to bring something to market. But it will come to market. And then as islandable grids, you're seeing this in Australia already, where you have these. You have a little town, and then there's what's called a feeder wire. So it's this one wire that runs forever to the nearest generating plant to this town, right? And then if there's a windstorm, that feeder wire comes down, the town has no power, and somebody has to go out and fix it. So one of the things that's beginning to happen with those kinds of wires is that as microgrid technology gets much, much stronger, those towns are being converted into microgrids, and they're taking the wires down. So that sort of wirelessness, it will clean up some of the wires that one sees driving around. Nantucket is another example. They have a cable that goes from the mainland, I think it's 26 miles out, that runs along the seabed and then up to Nantucket. It's a place where I know they don't have any plans to do this. They just got a new wire, which they're really happy with, but it's a place where you could conceivably put in, a microgrid, and that would have the same kinds of problems as the big grid. So they would still have to figure out how to balance the variable renewables that are in there. But that's being worked out too in usually rich islands or in places like Australia where you have relatively speaking, wealthy towns that are fairly isolated. So some of the bigger wires will come down, but effectively, because the wire and the electricity are the same thing, you can't get rid of the wires completely.
Mm, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how we've gotten used to like just pulling things out of the air, you know, music or movies, power, and that that's what we've come to expect. You write that consumers are not the arbiters of the grid, but their predilections do affect it. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing where we're pushing at all of the time at the system these days. And there were ways in which there were like these little kind of radical pockets that were doing that already beginning in the 1970s. But it's become kind of to go back to where we started the conversation, where it's become somehow okay for people who don't know anything about electricity and who aren't radical in any particular political kind of way, who don't have some sort of great ideological push to make their electricity system work differently, are nevertheless making decisions about that electricity system, about the governance of a local network, for example. There are towns that are in California especially, but also in New York, there are towns that are defecting from their utility and creating their own little, you know, managing their own electricity supply independently. And it's only going to be a matter of time before they figure out how to do what's called islanding, which means that they can be connected to the big grid, or they can shut themselves down from the big grid. So if there's a blackout, that little island will continue to work. So that's pushing it. Certainly this feeling of not wanting to like hunt around for an outlet is pushing it. And when I first started the book, I was sitting in an, I was actually in LaGuardia airport, and there was this guy in this like suit that cost more money than I would make in 6 months, right? Sitting on the dirtiest carpet you can imagine with his phone. Is at that point it was like a PDA, it was one of these with Blackberries, right, plugged into this like totally ill-placed outlet. And I was like, that's gonna change, right? Like, that's just not how it's gonna keep being. And then we got these, like, by the time I had the first draft of the book done, they had these little tower of power, you know, now mm-hmm. in the airports, so you can sit in a chair and plug your stuff in. But then what's coming, obviously, is that there'll be probably a system you have to pay for, but they'll be hidden in the walls. You log into it with your phone. You set the frequency correctly. It's probably the wrong word, frequency, for the engineers out there, but you set something correctly. And your phone will simply charge from the system, and it will drain some kind of money out of your bank account while it's putting electricity into your phone. But you won't have to plug it in at all.
And why, I mean, why is it, you write about this in the book, that, you know, wireless, pads charging is been around for a while, like forklifts get charged on mm-hmm. pads. But, you know, many people use iPhones in the United States. And why don't they, any ideas why they don't have that yet? I mean, I think it might be coming, but why?
Yeah, they will. They will. And I'm actually not even sure. I should look at the latest version of the IKEA software, but I think that it might actually charge iPhones at this point. Mm. It's the technology for the Android is just a little bit simpler.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. There was a blackout that was caused by one of the most mundane reasons in 2003. Can you tell a little bit about that story with the trees that involved this huge blackout?
Yeah, and did you read there's a footnote, a secret little hidden footnote about that story too. It's the 2003 East Coast blackout, which was massive. It was massive. I can never remember the number of people that were actually blacked out, but it was all of the East Coast for a day and a half, I think. And it was caused by three overgrown trees and a computer bug in Ohio. So I don't even know what else to say about it, but the details of it become so mundane, mm-hmm. Which is that the greatest threat to our grid today, despite like all of this worries about terrorism and all of the worries about how like unthinking individuals are actually intervening in the workings of the system, the greatest threat is actually foliage. And so you should look at trees with a sense of horror. You know, I look out my window and I see a tree basically wrapped around an electrical feeder that's coming into my house. I can't get up there, cut it, you know, the branches down. So that's everywhere. Like, that's the world of the grid, is that there's just a lot of trees in America and they grow. And a lot of them are on private property and a lot of them are on city property, and cities don't necessarily have the money to keep up good tree trimming schedules. Utilities find ways to spare money by limiting or making optional tree trimming schedules. So they'll go from trimming every 3 years to trimming every 5 years. And even if they don't meet that, there's no oversight on that, or having a crew with three people to having a crew with two people. And in this way, they can kind of balance their budget. The utilities are having a lot of trouble fiscally right now, so they are trying to find ways to just stay afloat. And tree trimming budgets is a good way to do that. But what that means is that I think PG&E actually made a clearance. They made their clearance like 1 inch, something like that. Mm. So you have a tree that's 1 inch from a power line. If that line, you know, on a hot day, line sag, metal just does this, like just sags down when it's hot out. And so that 1 inch means nothing. Like, a line is going to touch that tree, or a line is going to be close enough to that tree to touch that tree for the electricity to jump, to arc, it's called, over to the tree. And that's what happened. That's what started the 2003 blackout, was a tree which was a little bit too tall. It's not clear. We don't have a count on the actual height of the tree because when the federal investigators went back to find the tree, it had been cut down and all of the wood had been stacked up. It was missing the very top piece. Mm. So they and the utility said that someone must have just taken it home for firewood.
Huh.
So nobody knows how tall the tree was. And for this reason, there have been no criminal charges against the utility, because there's no proof that they, in fact, let the tree get too tall. But what was left of the tree was already really, really tall, probably taller than it should have been, right? And we know that particular utility had been cutting its tree trimming schedule. They had actually moved it from a 3-year to a 5-year. So whatever, that's the trees are growing. It's a problem. So that tree touched, and when a tree touches a wire, one of the things that happens is it will short the wire out, or the wire will arc, which means it just shoots lightning. Essentially, instead of following the wire, the electricity goes wild, and it just turns into lightning, and it just shoots out and hits whatever is nearest, exactly like lightning does. And it's usually the nearest thing is the tree, but it can be the roof of somebody's house or something else. And yeah, of course, what's funny about that story is that there's a kid who's at home, a teenager who's at home under that first tree, and he's 18, but he's sitting at home, and he hears this giant bang, and then all of his outlets start to smoke. So they had to buy some new appliances, those people, after that. And then, so that happens, and then there's another, there are two more trees. It was quite a hot August day, so the wires were sagging down. That's part of the problem. So there were two more trees that shorted out. And at that point, the electricity that's moving through the system, so electricity is always going to where it's needed. It's one of the natures of electricity is that where it sees sort of this call of least resistance, it will go in that direction. It's called a sink. So there isn't somebody that has to program the grid when you turn on your light to say, like, electricity, come over here. Electricity notices that there's a pathway open to it, and it moves there. And it doesn't take the shortest route, because it travels at sort of roughly the speed of light. It just takes all the routes. So to make an electric grid work, you just need a lot of routes available to the electricity. But when you start to take down wires, these duplicate routes, there's only so many duplicate wires in place. So they start to come down, and the electricity still wants to go where it was going, where it's needed, where there's like, it's like your light that's turned on is calling out to electricity, over here, over here, over here. And electricity is going in that direction, but it can't get there. And so it starts overloading the smaller wires. It starts overloading wires, and those wires then click off automatically. They have this sort of this fuse box thing that I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. So they're not dying. They're just self-protectively shutting down. Then the electricity has no way to get to where it's going. So all of this is happening, and it's the beginnings of a blackout. That's what you could call the beginnings of a blackout. And meanwhile, in the control room, there's a computer bug that is making it so that the alarms, neither the on-screen alarms nor the auditory alarms, are going off. They'd had a computer upgrade at midnight the night before. Nobody knew that this had happened. So the guys in the computer room don't. There's nothing to tell them that the system isn't working the way that it should be, except people start to call on the phone.
Say there's smoke coming out of my outlets.
Yeah, there's smoke coming out of my outlet. But even like people one utility over, it's just like there's something really wrong, right? And in the control room, it's called First Energy in Ohio, they're like, no, we don't see anything. You know, everything's fine. After like the 10th one of these phone calls, they start to be like, oh, something is not fine. They start to figure out that there's a problem. And thanks to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, by the way, a shout out to them, because they did all this research. I just read through their archives of they have records of these telephone conversations, which are absolutely hysterical. You know, I mean, hysterical in retrospect, not for the people who were in them, but in retrospect. And they did all of this work reporting on the ways in which the various parts of this blackout kind of complemented each other to produce what effectively happened. Mm-hmm. And the blackout spread because Ohio, because the electricity was doing this instead of going to where it was being called, it was trying to go and couldn't go. Ohio looked to the East Coast like a giant sink. It looked like there wasn't enough electricity in Ohio. So because the grid is interconnected, all of this electricity came flooding out of the East Coast into Ohio, which was a system that didn't have enough lines to even deal with the electricity that was there. So it comes flooding into Ohio, and suddenly it like bounces back. There isn't a sink in Ohio. There's too much electricity in Ohio. It bounces back back over. So the East Coast, New York State, the first thing they see is like this massive pull of electricity out of their system, and then this wave crashing of electricity, just like, and it's going to destroy everything, right? It's going to burn out everything. It's going to start destroying power plants. It's coming in just in a way that it cannot be controlled. So they just shut everything down. They shut down the lines that connect them to Ohio. So that's how you get the blackout in New York. Mm-hmm. It was actually self-protective. It was like, everybody needs to stay away from Ohio. So when people say a cascading blackout, it's that there's a little thing that turns into another thing, that turns into another thing, that turns into another thing, right? So that's the problem with that story. It's a beautiful story. It's dramatic in all of the perfect ways, right? But the problem with it is that it doesn't show that the other thing that had happened was the liberalization of energy trading it had been through the Supreme Court. It was a very, very long process, I think 10, 12 years in process, but it had just become the law that you could trade energy in a way, you could arbitrage energy. So you could buy low here and sell dear over there. And that was a new thing. And it meant that there was electricity moving across distances that it hadn't before on a system that was not built for that kind of power exchange. And it was moving in all kinds of different ways that it never had before on that system. And so there was a kind of vulnerability that hadn't been worked out yet on the transmission system, on the big system, that as soon as like one or two little things go wrong, it just cracked apart. So the question is, could that blackout out have happened a year earlier? Would it have been possible before the legislative change that made the grid, the electricity work differently on the grid? Would it have happened? And of course, we don't know that. And all of this money then went from the federal government into the transmission system. So we have quite a robust transmission system. In the meantime, right, everything that's happening now on the grid is happening on the distribution system, which is where none of the money has gone, because the reaction was, well, we don't want that 2003 blackout to happen again. So we react to the circumstances which produced it, right? But under the wires, so sort of what they say, south of the meters or south of the substation. So you have the substation, you have a local substation, you have a distribution grid, which is a lower voltage grid. That's where you put your solar panels, where you're going to be selling energy from person to person one day, where storage questions come into play. All of that is happening here, smart meters. And then above the meter, above the substation, you have the transmission network, which is where generation used to happen with these long lines that brought power from big factories far away into urban areas. But now urban areas, they're making a lot of power right where they're using it. They're storing a lot of power right where they're using it. And all of that's happening on the system of distribution lines, which is not particularly robust.
Well, and that gets back to the transparency, right? I mean, people whose lights went out in 2003, probably, you know, very few of them understood what it had to do with that deregulation. And in 2000, I think it's the same thing. I mean, I worked in San Francisco where first I was a temp and there were, you know, no one had computers. And then by, 2000, 2001, everyone had, there were all these internet companies and we would experience these blackouts and brownouts every day. You know, we just all have to go home. And, you know, I just thought, well, this is because there's so many internet companies in San Francisco, but it had to do with the way PG&E was managing the power, right?
Yeah, it wasn't just PG&E. It was actually a beautiful piece of legislation because it was this rare bill. It was the California deregulation bill that made everybody happy. So everybody was happy who put the bill together. But in the end, what the bill was just this sort of series of loopholes strung together with words. So as soon as it came out, it was obliging the utilities in California, both the big two, PG&E and Southern California Edison, but also all the little guys, to all behave according to a new set of regulations. And the utilities are very, very, very strongly regulated. So they don't get to, there's no way for them to say, like, by the way, this doesn't work. Like, this new regulation, it doesn't work, actually. That's like a 3-year process. So there were all these loopholes. It was the internet was just happening, right? That's why there were all these computers in San Francisco right then. And loophole exploitation was the name of the game. Mm-hmm. Everybody was doing it. And as soon as anybody could figure out how to do it with electricity, they were doing it with electricity. And we know about a lot of the gaming that was happening because Enron went bust And so we had access to the internal documents of that company. So we could actually see what they were doing. Essentially, I mean, some of the stuff that was very nefarious was like calling up power plants and saying, hey, by the way, you're scheduled for maintenance, right? Even when they weren't scheduled for maintenance. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of the most sort of mundane thing is that there was there's only a couple of places where the grid, the Northern California grid and the Southern California grid tie together. And Enron bought most of the transmission space on one of those. And then they would just say, they would just report, oh, it's full. Hmm. And even if it wasn't full, and then they would get paid to clear it up. They would just like make money to produce space on a transmission line that wasn't, that didn't, that was full of space to begin with. So they did a lot of stuff like that. They would go up through Oregon and then back, you know, down through, I guess, Nevada, and, you know, and then it would be, there would be electricity that was made in California that nevertheless crossed state lines. So it looked like it was made outside of the state. And then California, the utilities would have to pay three times as much for it, but they couldn't pass that on to the customer. There were all of these ways of just like sucking cash, companies just to suck cash out of the utilities who had no, they couldn't fight back from that. And they just had no means. There was no structure for them to say like, this isn't working for us. And PG&E in particular has a very long history of not being a kind and gentle utility to its people. And so people don't like them. In this particular case, like, They were having a horrible time, but because also of this history of like people just not trusting PG&E, not liking PG&E, just assuming PG&E is doing everything wrong, they were like, but we can't, you know, like nobody would listen to them. So when Enron finally blew up, then it became clear what was happening and the ways in which they'd had their hands tied behind their back by this terrible, terrible bill. And every time now I see arguments happening in legislatures, state legislatures, and also the federal government, where that goes on forever, and you get these bills that are like 10 million pages long, and half of everybody is really pissed off at the other half of everybody. I think that's right. That's the right way to make a bill. Because if you just look at that California deregulation bill where they're like, yay, everyone's happy. It's like happiness is not how you run an electrical system. Right, that's just not how it works. It's probably not how you run a government either. All of that debate that seems like it's going nowhere. It, in some cases, probably it's going nowhere. But I think in many cases, it's about people who understand systems trying to make that understanding be a part of a piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for joining us. I could talk to you for another hour about this. This book is full of great stories, kudzu, politics, Tesla, just some amazing stories. It's a great read. It's out now. It's coming out in paperback soon, right? This summer?
Yeah, in July. And somebody just told me that it's a thriller for geeks.
Yes.
Which I'm going to see if they can put that on the paperback.
It really is. And the story keeps going on. So it's not over yet. What are you working on next?
You know, I'm still, it's sort of sad because the biggest kind of ways in which the grid is resolving itself into something like a vision for the future or a structure for the future, it's happening right now. So I'm following that. It's not in the book, but it's just sort of seeing what's happening. In another year or two, I think something will have kind of settled down, in fact. And there will be a sense of the clear avenues in the directions in which things are changing. Whereas when I finished the book, it was still kind of a crapshoot. So I'm looking at those things and just trying to understand how they fit into the bigger story. I think of it, I haven't written anything, but I think of it as the phantom chapter. In some ways, I'm researching the phantom chapter of the book.
So the sequel.
Yeah, I don't think it will be a sequel because it's only going to be one chapter. But maybe, you know, if they ever reissue it, I'll write the one chapter, or maybe I'll write something for, I don't know, like The Atlantic or something close the cover on the book, I guess, would be the right metaphor.
Awesome. Well, Gretchen, thank you so much. Gretchen Bakke is a cultural anthropologist. She's at BakkeConsolidated.org. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Get the book.
My pleasure. Thank you for all of it. It's wonderful to talk.
Take care.
You too.
Triangulation records every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific. Leo Laporte hosts along with me when I sneak in here. You can find all the old episodes of Triangulation, and you can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/try. Thank you so much for joining us.